So Dave, once upon a time, sometime in like February 2020, it was before that, but sometime around then I said, hey, we should resurrect that idea of doing a podcast like East and West. I don't know, Eastern civilization, Western civilization. I wasn't sure what to call it. And, you know, I thought I said, why don't you revisit your notes and we'll do, you know, 10 episodes, something like that, 12 episodes.
Right.
Here we are, a year and a half later. So is it about time for a little, midway debriefing?
Sounds good.
So I went and read a little bit about, like, the theory of history. So, you know, what people think history is. And there's a text that everybody apparently refers to, an Oxford guy named E.H. Carr, a book from 1967. And he says there was, you know, a real tendency to do moralizing history in the 1830s. And there was what he calls a positivist revolt. So I heard this term positivist when I started working at York. A lot of colleagues with social science backgrounds would throw around this term and be like, you're a positivist. And I never knew what it was. And eventually I came to the idea that it's specific to social science, and it's some kind of idea that you know, there are objective facts and you build your theory on these facts. And so, you know, E.H. Carr, he discusses this and he says, you know, is history a bunch of facts? And we actually talked about this at the beginning of our show where we said, you know, I don't know about it being consisting solely of facts, we certainly can't do anything unless you have some facts. Mm-hmm. He quotes someone named Hausmann. Again, these are all names I don't know much about, but he says, accuracy is a duty and not a virtue. So you don't get a cookie for getting your factual information correct. In fact, if you don't get your factual information correct, you should be thrown out.
You should be, yeah.
So, but, you know, Carr says there are infinite facts and not all of them are important to history. Otherwise, we're just making encyclopedias. So he talks about the idea of a selection bias in the sources, how most writing in medieval times, for example, was done by people in the church. They were the only people who could read. So you're going to think maybe that people's lives were ruled by religion potentially a lot more than they were, because the people whose lives weren't producing the documents that you could then use to build a history of medieval times.
Right. Yeah, the facts are obviously the building blocks of the whole enterprise, but it's the analysis and the interpretation that are, you know, really significant. Even encyclopedias, they're not just collections of facts.
That's right. I mean, God knows Wikipedia is not.
Right.
And then Carr has a discussion of documents where he says, you know, remember that he has some cautions about documents where he says, remember, these are just telling you what the author thought. So you have to, it's not just because you found a record of something from 1698, it doesn't mean that that is the truth about 1698, right? It's what the author was thinking.
Well, one of the components of the course you took with me was, was writing an essay, not a research paper, an essay. You're going to find the facts, analyze and interpret them, and take a position. And I would be teaching a lesson on how to do citations. And after a while, some student would always ask, like, do we have to cite everything? I said, no, there are things you don't have to cite, your own opinion, certain facts. And then we started breaking down the facts. What is a fact? So if you're talking about a famous person's date of birth, you're pretty safe not citing that. But it turns out that quite a few things that the students thought were incontrovertible facts are not.
Yeah.
So the documents you talk about, there's no such thing as a factual document.
Right.
Even if it's a list from ancient Sumer of the contents of a warehouse, you know, like how many jars of oil does it have?
Yeah, though everybody knows how much Sumerian clerks lied in their record keeping.
Well, yeah, maybe the inventory was falsified so that the chief priest wouldn't find out that we've been skimming. But there are certain documents that you really have to hold up to the light. Memoirs,
right,
written, you know, many years after the fact are often so unreliable that they're unusable. The person will be justifying what they did, whitewashing unpleasant facts.
The guy who, the CIA guy who organized the coup against Lumumba and the orchestrated the arrival of Mobutu to power, Lawrence Devlin, he was the chief of station in Congo during and just, you know, for quite a while after independence. He wrote a memoir called Chief of Station, Fighting the Cold War in a Hot Zone. And it's the most self-serving document you'll ever believe. And it's also like, hey, he's a CIA agent. His job is lying. Like, how could a historian use a document? Like, what value is a document like that?
You know, well, it's immensely valuable because if you can catch him in a lie,
which I, yeah, you can repeatedly,
which you can do on every page, probably.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now you start saying, ah, interesting. So what is he lying about and why is he lying?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the hard work. You know, when people say history is hard work,
not memorizing the facts. It's investigating them and analyzing and interpreting them. That's the part.
Can you teach that? I mean, that, you know, I don't know if you found this with high school students, but with undergrad university students, and there are always exceptions, and I don't want to, you know, I know we have young listeners, and I'm not, you know, trying to disparage, but there's a couple of tendencies that I always see when you tell people, you know, you have to cite everything but your own opinion. I find people will just say, I didn't like this or something. And it's like, not quite what we're looking for when we say, you know, your opinion, you know, or they'll be like, I didn't like the way Napoleon wrote this or something. And then the other thing that I find people that are just getting into it do is they hedge. So they'll try to say, you know, the Nazis, you know, well, we haven't covered the Nazis. So let's say something we have covered. Let's say Napoleon's, you know, chopping up Haitians into pieces and throwing them, you know, Leclerc throwing them into the sea, whatever. That's bad. But, you know, France also brought a lot of economic progress to Haiti. So that's good. And then they'll always try to find the two sides.
And I think there's also the use of language where you would say, you know, may have or might have, but that's not wishy-washiness. That's simply leaving room for doubt, which I think is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, that's good. I'm just saying something I noticed that students can learn. But how do you go about, if you're trying to get students to be more skeptical and to be critical of sources, I mean, how do you do that?
Okay, we're jumping ahead here to scientific method in history, or is history a science? Okay, here's an anecdote from my experience. I took a second year compulsory history course. It was called Historiography and the Great Historians. It was broken into two parts. The second part was historical schools, great historians who had an impact not only on the story, but also on the historians, you know, as in this is how you do it sort of thing, or this is how you don't. That's also an important lesson.
Yeah, I bet.
The first part, historiography, suggests that history is some kind of science with a method.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the course was taught by a rather unenthusiastic prof who built the entire course around two assignments. Okay. So the second half ended up being seminar. We all had to do research and do a presentation on a great historian or a school of historians. But the first half was built around a single enormous assignment. It was a bibliography.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was collecting all of the sources on an exceedingly narrow topic.
Okay, so the idea is how to you learn how to be exhaustive about something.
Yes, and you also learn about a number of sources that you might not be aware of. Yeah. You know, instead of going to the library, we didn't have computers and the internet in those days, so you would go to the library and physically find a book, a journal, a review, articles in a collection. So you're digging. It's basically grunt work that a research assistant would do and would get paid for. It's tiring, takes a long time, and as you might imagine, it's not particularly exciting. Now, it's even less exciting when the prof gives you a topic, which is what happened. So I got the thrilling topic of Canada and the League of Nations.
Okay.
And I was to find every book, article, review written on that subject. So I'm digging through archives and just looking for references. I'm not actually reading the documents. I learned literally nothing about Canada and the League of Nations other than the titles of the things written about it.
Right, because you didn't have to read it.
No.
So you just had to find it.
Right. And then a huge chunk of our grade was whether we followed proper bibliographic form.
Right.
And I'm typing this on a, you know, manual typewriter from the late 18th century. It was just a horrible assignment and completely useless. Well, it wasn't. Sorry, I shouldn't say that. I did discover that there were many more types of sources that I did not know about. Much, much more useful would have been a smaller annotated bibliography.
Right.
Instead of finding 150 sources, take 10, read them, do the bibliographic entry. So there's your form and stuff. You know, we can do all that part. Mm-hmm. But then I have to write, you know, a paragraph or two, a brief analysis of what is this? Is it reliable? Who wrote it? When was it written? Did it have an impact? Like all of those things. And then you learn a great deal about what sources are more trustworthy, less trustworthy, more useful, less useful. So I know that there are high school classes that do annotated bibliographies. I don't know that the students are going to get real excited about that.
Well, you know, my buddy John Elmer, who's at the who does the Brief podcast, and we were doing that together for a while, and now I try to jump on there whenever the scheduling permits. But Elmer put me onto this bibliographic software called Zotero. He was raving about it for many years before I just figured, like, just, you know, keep notes and make a bibliography at the end. But Zotero is like a database, and now you can install a plugin on your browser. So when you go on Amazon or when you go on, you know, one of the websites that has papers, scientific papers or social science papers, whatever, there will be a little icon that says, do you want to just suck this entry, bibliographic entry, into your Zotero, which is installed on your computer. Mm-hmm. And then you can file it, and then you can kind of click all the entries in a database and make your bibliography and paste it into your document. You know, you should read it over, but it'll do the formatting for you into MLA or APA style or whatever.
So. Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It was useful enough that when I wrote America's Wars on Democracy in Rwanda and the DR Congo, I actually went through my entire written book of whatever 300 plus pages and entered all of those into the database so that I could write bibliographies for them, because it was better. It was still more efficient, because that was my big fear. I was like, isn't the data entry part of it, you know, the hard part? And in fact, even having done all the work and having to repeat the data entry part, it was still worth doing. So that'll probably change the future bibliographic historiographic assignments that are assigned.
Yeah, yeah. And I had a Sorry, I got a cough. I think I mentioned to you a course that I took with a professor named Brown. He would give us a document, a very small one. And the assignment was to find out, okay, who said this, when, and why? And what does it uh-huh. mean? And that last question is pretty wide open,
yeah.
depending on the little document you get. So it was usually less than 2 pages long, usually yeah. 1 page, that's it. But now you have to find out, okay, who is the person who said this? And when did they say it? What were they referring to? And, you know, do you believe them?
Yeah.
Another approach would be to give students two quite different pieces of information about the same thing, about the same event or the same person. So imagine two diametrically yeah. opposed descriptions of Robespierre.
Right.
And then say, you know, how does this happen? The two historians using the same facts come up with completely different interpretations of this person.
So I you also taught us a specific thing where you said, you know, go through your sources, make notes of the quotes, write them out if necessary, and then on paper, and then cut them up and arrange them on the floor, and then that's the kind of like the skeleton of your.
Oh, that was, yeah, that's more an organizational tool, which I think yeah. can apply to almost anything. It's basically cut and paste before computers did it
yeah.
for you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. It was good. And I'll, you know, I've taught students to do that. And then it's interesting because one limitation that I found was this question of like, what's your opinion? Because the article, you know, people have accused me of saying like, you overquote because I've been so trained to not plagiarize and attribute everything to whoever I'm attributing it to that the article then becomes like a succession of quotes. And I'm like, hey, but I arrange the quotes and I pick the quotes, so I'm still there. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. You chose the facts and you told them in the order you wanted.
Yeah.
And you chose the quote. Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, people can still be like, it's not necessary. There's also a difference between like what is good integrity in terms of that kind of writing approach and what's pleasurable to read, right?
Oh, yeah.
So people may not find it all that. If you're writing for money, whatever, then people may not find it all that, you know, readable to just have a succession of quotes from other people. Like, why did well, I?
And then we're back this? To documents, right? Can you yeah. trust what's in this document?
Right.
So memoirs are unreliable. Diaries are more honest, but they most often tell you more about the person who wrote them and what they thought was important or wasn't important.
Remember Lord Elgin's diary of the Opium yeah. War?
Yeah. But he wrote that conscious that it was going to be a memoir.
Yeah. yeah
so he's already lying from the get-go. But I'm thinking of a book I read that quoted extensively from the diary of Winston Churchill's daughter,
okay,
who was, I think, around 18 in 1940,
right?
Something like that. It's fascinating in the sense that there are some things she's very aware of, and there's others that she's blissfully unaware of. And then somewhere right. in the middle of her diaries, she really has a revelation. She sees the suffering of other people, like, right in front of her and realizes, oh my God, I'm a sheltered ninny.
She right? has that moment in
she
her
does.
Own
and
diary?
It,
wow.
It's very, yeah, it makes you like her a lot more because before that you're thinking, oh my God, girl, get out of the house.
Yeah.
Eyewitnesses, you know, go to a criminal court and listen to testimony. It's amazing. You could have five or six people see exactly the same thing. And their stories don't match.
Yeah. Well, Dan, you know, Dan, who is on the podcast often as well, he when he was, I think he was a student at York, but, you know, there was this, there's sometimes like demonstrations at York where pro-Palestine students and pro-Israel students have various demonstrations at the same time and they're yelling at each other and so on. And there was one incident where all the pro-Israel organizations said that, claimed that the Palestinians were chanting all kinds of horrific anti-Semitic stuff. And Dan did that. Dan sort of said, okay, look, If you look at all of the claims in the media now of these supposed slogans, they all go back to two, you know, sources. And one of them wasn't there. And the other one does not say that, you know, that they were chanting this. So somewhere along the way, there's been a fabrication. And it was another like, you know, detective work using student newspapers that I thought was very good. Like, it was a real public service. But that's often what happens, where in history, you'll have a whole bunch of, you know, books, for example, or articles or stories, and they're only interpreting one or two primary sources. Mm-hmm. And those could be, you know, tendentious or biased.
I call them problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the same is true of journalists.
Yeah.
Just because you're on the spot doesn't mean that you understand what you're seeing.
That's right. That is huge. I can't. Yeah. And that, you know, one of my favorite genres of writing is where someone who knows what the person is seeing and interprets that report, the clueless journalist report, in terms of, you know, actual context. And so the journalist didn't know, but the analyst does. I mean, there's Chomsky does this all the time. Where, yeah. You know, he wasn't there. He wasn't there, but he has total confidence, right? Like, he's like, yeah. No, you didn't see that because that didn't happen.
Right. Yeah. Trump's claim to have witnessed crowds of Muslims celebrating after 9/11.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly.
But there's also the journalist who goes to a foreign capital and interviews
taxi drivers.
Yeah. Or I spoke to dozens of people. Actually, you spoke to six. And they all speak English because you're unilingual.
Yeah.
And you met them at an embassy reception. So you spoke to, you know, right, this limited group of people, and you're going to base your interpretation.
And they all want the U.S. to come and invade the country.
Imagine.
It's amazing.
Consensus.
So, yeah, science, I mean, maybe, like, not every science has to be, you know, based on a small number of provable axioms or, you know.
No, I think the calling history a science is an attempt to impose some kind of internal discipline and set up a method,
yeah,
that is going to be consistent and more reliable. And I just don't know if that's possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Even going back a long way in history.
So if we're not in the realm of science, if we can't just specify these methods and put people in labs and have them study with you know, senior scientists about how to do it, then we're in the realm of philosophy, right? And so Voltaire, apparently, it was who coined the phrase the philosophy of history. Mm-hmm. But Carr says, you know, in the Anglo world, they don't talk about the philosophy of history because it's self-evident. And Carr also, he talks about an interesting thing, which is like how the past, at least the writing of history, changes based on the present. So he talks about, his example is, after the Russian Revolution, there was a lot of writing on the French Revolution that's totally different. Mm-hmm. And like, this is you know, if you look at any history of Rwanda that's written after 1994, they basically portray the whole thing as leading up to the genocide. Like, everything that happened prior to 1994 was leading up to the genocide, right?
Right.
And it's like, if you look at history before, at documents that were produced before 1994, there's all kinds of stuff going on. There's cooperation, there's, you know, alliances between different groups, there's regional tensions between North and South. Nobody would have, you know, predicted that this was all headed in this direction.
Yeah, I just finished a book that basically blames Napoleon for World War I and II.
Oh, I thought it was 1648, the Peace of Westphalia.
Right. Yeah, as if you know, this was inevitable. Once Napoleon did this, that ensured the rise of Prussia, which leads directly to the Kaiser and Hitler Like, really? You think Napoleon had a clue that that's what was going to happen?
And he went well, I mean, that's, did it anyway. Yeah. You know, Trotsky, I guess, and Trotskyists have this, you know, view almost that, like, there's this kind of engine of history, right? I mean, they got it from Marx, but mm-hmm. I think they take it to that level of, like, where everything that happened was kind of the only thing that could have happened. And, you know, it's when you think of history, you know, every moment there are paths that are not taken or decisions that could have changed the course of history, but maybe they couldn't have. Maybe no matter what, you're going to be railroaded into this outcome.
Yeah, this detecting patterns is what happened with the Russian Revolution. As you say, people went back and rewrote the French Revolution and said, aha,
yeah,
look at all the similarities.
Right.
Therefore, there's a pattern to revolutions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then they tried. And at that time, after the Russian Revolution, they were obsessed with the science and positivism. And so they were trying to come up with scientific schemes and formula to predict history, right?
Which is like economics.
Yeah. Yeah, right, right. So, you know, there's also the question of your point of view, which, you know, I imagine we're going to get into more your point of view and my point of view when we go towards closer to the present and World War One and Two and the Russian Revolution and communism, because I'm, you know, very sympathetic to those projects, and I'm not going to, I might as well just say that. Probably my listeners mostly are too. But
we haven't made any real attempt to conceal our interpretations. In fact, we've been pretty upfront with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So there's a question of, you know, if you have a point of view, as we do, there's also a question of, like, fairness, right? Even if objectivity is not necessarily something that is possible or can be aspired to, fairness is the idea that you consider facts that don't fit your interpretation, counter arguments and things that, you know, might make Robespierre look not great, you know, might not paint him in a good light, even if you are inclined to try to defend.
Objectivity and fairness doesn't mean that you're going to treat all arguments equally.
Right.
It means you're going to approach them with a sense of fairness. And, you know, I'm willing to look at this argument, but if it's garbage, I think objectivity means saying this is garbage.
Right.
But that's something that should be taught as well. You should teach students, here's the historical event and here's what people say. Here are five or six different interpretations of the same thing.
Yeah, you actually had us do an assignment, I think, and we had an option to write like a series of letters as mm-hmm. like a country person living through the French Revolution
or something. Yeah, or a clergy or noble or
right.
middle class. Yeah, the perspective changes everything.
So about the machine, the historical machine that just is churning its way through and inevitably doing it. So there's, you know, that's like the caricature of the Marx position, which is like, you know, the means of production, the class structure, the state of technology, the struggle between, you know, of classes. And that's like the motor of history. And so these are like vast impersonal forces. But then on the flip side, there's like that heroic, you know, liberal, I guess, heroic idea of, you know, there are these great men. There's Napoleon. I mean, when you say great men, it always starts with Napoleon. But then there's also, you know, whatever British great men there are. Wellington and...
Yeah, so you're Admiral picking Nelson. On Carlyle, and we've already expressed our feelings about his body of work. Yeah, the 19th century was dominated by this great men school. So biographies or history where, you know, kings and great generals do these things, and that's how history works. And there was a reaction to that, as there so often is. And in the 1920s and 30s, the French founded the Annales school, as in the annals of history.
Uh-huh.
And they started collecting information that was completely opposite to the great men's school. So demographics, social change,
I think economic change. Is Mark Bloch?
Yes.
Mark Bloch, that's an interesting story because I read his book about why France lost to Nazi Germany. I guess we'll talk more about that.
Okay. Strange defeat. I'm thinking of Fernand Braudel's incredible work. The history of the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up on the great men style of history, but you read Braudel and realize, oh my gosh, there's so much going on mm-hmm. that has nothing to do with what the king did or what battle was fought. There's so much going on in so many spheres of society and the economy and people's diets are changing and so on.
C.L.R. James is a good example of balancing those, I find. Because the Black Jacobins obviously is the story of Toussaint Louverture.
Right.
And like, what a choice for, if you want to do great man theory of history, like, that's a good choice. But then he's also, a Marxist and he talks about the social forces a lot, the different social forces that are at play and actors. Yeah.
Balance is it. Right? Yeah. You definitely want to study the impersonal forces, but you can't leave individuals out of it. I dare you to write a history of the Cuban Revolution without ever mentioning Castro.
Well, it's funny that you say Cuba because there's like an afterword or a foreword, but there's like two essays that C.L.R. James wrote that are in the edition of Black Jacobins that I have. And one of them is, he wrote it. It's like written in like 1938 or something. So he wrote it and he said, Africa will be free and there's a process of decolonization that's underway. And that's why I wanted to write this history of Haiti so people know that there's a precedent. So he was quite consciously, writing this as, in light of present events and future events in 1938. And then he wrote some afterword or something in the 60s, I guess, after the Cuban Revolution, where he kind of compared Castro to Toussaint Louverture and this whole question of like he talks a lot about Castro and the Caribbean, right? He's like, the Caribbean.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So another one of your essays, I think your final exam of your history class was, has there been progress in history?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite questions. It would be some variety of we've been studying the past 500 years, more or less. And do you think that we have made progress or are we better off? So I would prime them in the last few days of class, just an open discussion. I'd say, are you smarter than your parents? Are you better off than people of two generations ago? And by then they were quite rightly suspicious of my questions. So they'd think for a second and go, yes and no. I'd say, great, super start. So now start organizing the yeses and the noes. What are the reasons that you think you're smarter than your parents? And it's amazing how often they would say, well, my parents can't program the VCR.
Yeah. I mean, environment. I was thinking in terms of in environmental terms, even back then when I remember writing that answer, but it was, it's hard to answer.
A little odd though.
It's hard to answer yes or no to that one, but it is a good like question to make you think about.
Well, sure. What you consider progress or not, that's interesting.
Well, I mean, like there are people who say things like, right now it's worse than slavery. It's like, let's look into what slavery entailed or the situation in South Africa is worse than apartheid. we need some detail. You need to know some details about what apartheid was.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, my next question. You've a year and a half you've spent doing this podcast. We have no time. There's no bell that's going to ring at the end. There's no new group of students waiting for the next class at the door that starts busting in when your time is up. But there's also no assignments. There's no deadlines. and it's once a week instead of, in your case, it's once a day. It was 5 days a week, right?
Yeah.
80 minutes or something. And an undergrad class is basically, I don't know, 2 hours a week or something for 13 weeks if it's a half term. So how do you find this compared to teaching?
Oh, well, I don't consider this teaching.
Right.
It took me several episodes to figure out, well, yeah, I guess there are some aspects of that, but I don't exactly know our audience. You've given me some hints.
Yeah.
I know certain individuals who are listening.
Right. And but, I send you some of the funnier tweets.
Yeah. Yeah. But when you're talking about a group of 17-year-olds, that's a different animal altogether. Mm-hmm. And as you say, every day for 90 or 75 minutes, which is a long, long time to be in a room with 30 17-year-olds or 35 back in your day. So what you wanted was some variety. The podcast is what it is. It's pretty much one thing. But in class, you could go with variety, different types of lessons. So obviously, I love to talk. I did a lot of that. I love to tell stories. But you can also intersperse visuals and film, music, student-directed activities. I was a big fan of debates and role-playing games and mock trials and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you can also do lessons directed at method. You know, here's how you write a short summary. Here's how you do this. You know, this will make you better in your other classes as well as this one, or this will be something that you'll see in university. So that kind of thing. You don't want to do that every day because after a while.
Yeah. And it's also kind of intense on you to organize all that.
Yeah. And then the other big difference with this podcast is we do one shot and then within 2 weeks we're, oh no, we should have done this, or I can't believe that came out now. Why didn't that come out a month ago so that we could have included it? And some of them are gruesome. You know, the discoveries around the residential schools.
But we did a pretty good job with that. You know, that our episode holds up, sadly.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I got some of the listeners to that would send me just crying emojis or whatever. They're like, I listened to your episode 3 on Canada, and then they just sent me a bunch of crying emojis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much about right.
But the other difference is when you're teaching, you pretty much know, or if you don't know, you'll find out that your first year is going to be probably at least a semi-disaster. If it's not a complete disaster, that's probably a victory. Because in your second attempt, you're going to be considerably better. Yeah. And then by the time you've taught a course, you know, multiple times, you're going to make so many revisions and changes to what you're doing. Plus, you're going to learn more. That's one of the great things about teaching is how much you learn. You know,
well, that's true about podcasting too.
Yes. But
for me, yeah, like teaching is like you're trying to elicit something from the student. And the more you know about what the student knows and where they're at and what they can do, the better you can calibrate that. And so it's, you know, I try to make it all about the student, you know. That's why even when I hear, you know, when I hear people say, oh, you're such a great teacher, I'm always like, and which I don't hear that often, I have to say, I'll be honest. There are lots of people that have that said about them. But I always think like, it's not, you know, it's not really about me, right? Like it's about, you know, I would rather the student say like, man, you know, damn, I know a lot. Or, you know, damn, I'm good.
Well, there, a Okay, so there's a huge difference in the audience of the podcast, even though I'm saying I don't know who they are. Yeah. Obviously, they're interested or they wouldn't have tuned in to listen. Whereas when you're teaching, you know, grade 10 history.
There's a captive audience.
Yeah, it's like these kids have been sentenced to a semester in prison. Now, there's some that are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready to go. And then there's some who are thinking, oh, this is going to suck. And your job is to convince them otherwise.
And they can on a podcast, they can pause. You know, like, I don't want to listen to this anymore. I'll come back to it later.
Well, sure. Or they can skip six episodes and go straight to the one that interests them most.
Yeah. But in class, you're stuck there.
Yeah. And you've got so many different types of students. And you try to appeal to them on different levels.
So, you know, when I'm teaching whatever it is, there's like a, for me, I always think of it in terms of like a skill set, you know, I think of it as like, I want them to be able to do things that they couldn't do before. That's university, right? Like that's what they sign up for. There are lots of reasons to go to university and we can talk about it. But like at the end of the day, the way I think about it is like, they want to develop some capacities that they didn't have and couldn't get otherwise. So like, but at the high school level as a teacher, are you trying to, you know, are you trying to give people this like some capacity? Are you aiming at, you know, possibly creating a future historian?
Oh, God, no. No. There were some students who liked history, but they had qualms and they'd say, I don't know, I really like history, but what kind of job can you get with history?
And you're like, you can't.
Actually, my answer would be anything.
Right.
Because if you're intelligent and hardworking and you've picked up a few skills here, like you can read something and understand what you're reading, mm-hmm. and you've got a few critical thinking tools, you can do anything.
Yes.
But, you know, am I saying go and study history? No. On the other hand, like I said, the more you learn about history, the more interesting it is, and then the more open you are to it. I always gave the example of, you know, you're sitting there flicking the channels, there's nothing on, and then you get to some documentary about ancient Egypt, and
right.
do you stop and watch it? And I would say the odds are, if you like history, you may, and then maybe you learn something that you didn't know before. So my goal was to have them at least like history a little, and then maybe they'll read some or watch some in future. I mean, the other goals are much more simple and generic. You know, we have to spend a semester together. I would like you to think that this was better than having your teeth pulled.
Okay, but look, so when you give a scientific presentation, I'll read like guidance on how to give a presentation or how to write. It's the same thing. It's like you have a shallow surface that people are reading on, and then every once in a while you go for a really deep dive for the people who are super interested, and you try not to stay there because if you stay there too long, you'll lose the people that are only interested in a shallow thing. And then you do that every once in a while. So when you do a deep dive, how deep would you go in the high school context?
Okay. I suppose the deepest we went with that course was probably the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
One reason that I would do more French Revolution than maybe some of my peers was that I knew more about it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then another reason was that I liked it.
Yeah.
So if you're teaching something you like, your enthusiasm is very often going to be infectious.
Right.
And then another reason was resources. As a young teacher, I got my hands on these French Revolution booklets that went through the revolution. And then it also contained the assignment where you take the role of a peasant or a, right?
Oh.
And then you respond to this. So here's, you know, the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen. So which articles appeal to you? So as the student, you're going to have to read the articles of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, which are enormously important. It's, you know, the foundation of modern democratic. Everybody else has copied them in one form, shape, or form. But you now have to pick and choose between them based on your perspective. So I thought that was a great exercise. So that's another reason for going into depth, is because you have the resources. I mean, later on, when the computer technology got better, I don't know if you remember, I used to show a lot of slides.
Yeah.
So in my travels in Europe.
Architecture, paintings.
Yeah. So in my travels, I would be, you know, at a museum or at an art gallery and haunting the shop and going, oh, I'll take that one and that one and that one, because I'm going to show them to students, you know, next year. Or I would be taking my own really bad photographs, or having my wife take better ones of castles and places, and as you say, paintings and anything that I thought, narrow streets, so that they got the idea of how old these towns were and that they predated cars and all that stuff. But now you can go on your computer and just search images and find all of those. And then you can create your own slideshow, and you can teach from the side of the room, just showing them, you know, pictures of the things you're talking about. And so, so immeasurably better. So if you have the resource.
So there has been progress.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, Marty Zablocki started getting me into that. And, you know, next thing you know, I had about several thousand images for every lesson I'm doing. I'm not just for the West and the wider world. I mean, for Canadian history and for anything you're doing.
So our curriculum for this podcast, I wonder, so the skeleton that I had imagined was, you know, the first year history class at U of T that I took, which was called, I don't remember, I don't think it was called Modern Western Civilization, but that was the idea. It was basically balance of power, politics, lots of emphasis on Napoleon. And I remember a little bit of World War I, almost nothing on World War II, nothing on the Cold War.
Oh gosh, my courses all ended in 1945.
Yeah, 1945, right, exactly. And then, you know, but then I was trying to add in all the other world history stuff that I took at U of T. So I took a Chinese history class second year, Indian history in, I think, second, third, and fourth years, and Arab history, modern Arab history, I think it was called, third year. And I took, obviously, Arabic language for 3 years. So, but I didn't take any Latin America at university. I took Spanish, and I, you know, it's funny because I worked a lot in Latin America and write a lot about it. But it was like after that summer, after grade 13, I went to the Mississauga Central Library and I tried to read something on like every country in the world. And that's when I found things like Memory of Fire by Eduardo Galeano and you know, Hind Swaraj by Gandhi and Discovery of India by Nehru. So I had an idea of what I wanted to put in here. But I guess the question, you know, looking at your notes and where we are, how much of your curriculum have we covered in terms of like content and historical events?
Most.
Right. So you didn't do that much World War I, II, Cold War.
Either. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did. Okay. But like how much of it?
Well, yeah. Okay. The thing is, every student in that class had to take grade 10 Canadian history.
Right.
Which is where we covered World War I and World War II in great depth.
Okay.
Plus the Cold War. I mean, obviously from a Canadian American perspective, but still. So in the Western course, you can refer to these things, jog their memory a little bit. Sometimes it was non-existent, but you know, I'm not going to reteach everything we did in grade 10, but you had that basis to work with.
Right.
And then in the West course, there were things that we can't do in the podcast. So, art and art and literature and music and things like that. I would do those in the high school class, but we skipped them in the podcast. We also didn't do the, all of the social history that I would have.
Right. So, but like I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, we're going to do a series on World War One, Two, and the Cold War. And it, I imagine, based on the notes we've been making, and if you include especially the Scramble for Africa series of unknown, thus far unknown dimensions, it's going to be potentially as long as this one. So I just wonder, is that an accurate... It's probably a little bit more than you would have done.
Oh, we've already covered far, far more.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the topics that we have done. Yeah. Try to imagine in the 1980s and 90s doing lessons on Haiti. I have no pictures.
Yeah.
I don't have the resources to put in the students' hands. It would basically be me reading a book about Haiti and then telling them about it.
Right.
So that's what I did. I had read Black Jacobins.
Right.
So as part of the French Revolution, I would go on a 10-minute spiel about Haiti, right, based on, you know, what I know, but I'm not going to spend there.
We didn't, in Mississauga, it's not like a Francophone place. There are lots of Haitians in Quebec, but like, I never met anyone from Haiti until I was an adult.
Right.
I didn't, you know, there was no way to, like, there's no coverage of it in the media or anything, so I wouldn't have known anything about it.
Yeah.
That's true. That's really true.
Yeah, and we were talking about it earlier, the composition of the class.
Yeah.
So when I first started teaching, I moved from Ottawa to Mississauga, and that was an eye-opener.
Yeah, yeah. Mississauga, for people who don't know, is a suburb of Toronto. And Toronto, I believe this so-called Greater Toronto area, 50% of the people who live in the Greater Toronto area were born outside of Canada. So it is, you know, Mississauga is one of the most diverse places probably on the planet in terms of like where people are from. And that's where, that's where I went to school.
Yeah. Whereas my high school in Ottawa was a French high school.
Right.
So slightly more than half of the students were French Canadian.
Right.
Then there were English Canadian kids whose parents wanted them to be bilingual. Mm-hmm. And then there was the Portuguese girl. And then there was, you know, and that was the ethnic breakdown.
Right.
So when I got to Mississauga and, you know, saw my first classes, actually at Thanksgiving, I went home to visit my family and I took my class list with me right, just to show them, like, you wouldn't believe the diversity of this class. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Portuguese and Filipino and Caribbean and Polish and, you know,
and I mean, in a way, that's part of it's part of what motivated some of the episodes that I wanted to do. I wanted to make sure we had a good episode about the Philippines and a good one about Jamaica, and those were two that I definitely felt.
Yeah, so you definitely want to throw in some content for, you know, the ethnic groups that are so heavily represented in your class, or you want to steer them to an essay topic that they can explore, you know, their background a little more.
So there's also like the idea of what our reading habits are, you know, in terms of like scholarly history versus popular history. Like you go and you go to the bookstore and you go to the history section, you'll see something different than if you are
in a university library
inside the footnotes of other books or whatever. Yeah. So what are your, I mean, you're obviously, you know, once you're out of university, you're, if you want to keep up with history, you're mostly going to be reading popular books, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
Most of my profs were absolutely scathing in their denunciation of popular history.
Yeah.
You know, they reserved a great deal of their ire for Barbara Tuchman, for example.
Oh.
So I thought, what's the
better
problem?
Check that out.
I had already read one of her books and I thought it was excellent. So I went and read a couple more and I said, you guys are idiots. She writes in a way that is easy to read.
Yeah.
The content is accurate. Like, what is your problem with her?
Right.
And there are others who are not professional historians. I have books on my shelf by R.F. Delderfield, who's an English novelist, and yet pretty good Napoleonic historian. And then there's Colleen McCullough.
Oh, Masters of Rome series.
Oh, that was awesome.
That was.
I mean, yeah. She's more famous for the Thornbirds, but if you read The First Man in Rome in that series,
wow,
she actually walked the streets of, you know, the ancient districts of Rome to get the timing right. Like, how far is it from here to here? And wow. I think that's a marvelous piece of work.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, there are other, you know, popular historians I'm not so thrilled with. I'm not a fan of Yuval Noah Harari.
Me neither. Or what's his name? There's a real imperial apologist that everybody that I read is always attacking, Neil Ferguson or something.
Oh, okay. Basically, but and then there's the also British. The danger of pseudo historians like David Irving.
Oh, and I don't know much about him.
Oh, he's a Brit who writes about Hitler and the Nazis, and he's an apologist.
Oh dear.
Oh, he's the worst. This is the guy who's suggesting, you know, the Holocaust didn't happen that way. Okay. It's not bad, right? And there's no proof that Hitler ordered it.
Oh my God.
Yeah, this was something that overzealous underlings did. It wasn't part of Hitler's plan.
We tripped and fell and killed 30 million people.
He's exactly the type of historian that you have to guard against. People have checked, you know, his stuff, and he has citations to non-existent sources.
That old trick.
Or he cites a source that says exactly the opposite of what he's arguing.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'll choose a small, small part of a quotation. Everybody else quotes the full quotation. He takes one little piece out and goes with the opposite interpretation.
But you see, you know what's interesting about this, though? It's interesting because on the one hand, he's politically repulsive. On the other hand, the way that we refute him is scientific in a way.
Yes.
Like, we have to say there are a set of methods that you have to use if you want to get an accurate, fair picture of the past. And this guy's not doing that. So therefore, what this guy's doing doesn't count as his historical method.
He gets published.
Fanfic or whatever.
But yeah. he gets published. He has a platform. Right. And he also encourages other, you would think, more serious historians, German historian Nolte. And these guys are, you know, kind of trying to reevaluate Nazism.
Oh, boy.
Right? We'll get to it when we get to World War II. But it's and the really, really disappointing thing is all of your students are watching the fact checkers catch Trump in a lie every day.
Yeah.
And what does it matter?
Right. Yeah.
That's disheartening.
It's a huge question because, like, the mainstream journalism or mainstream history, it, you know, has its propaganda elements to it, right? Like, there are fashions in academia. If you don't, you know, follow those fashions, you could face, you know, professional consequences. You could be driven out of profession. You know, there's peer review processes where, you know, somebody with an axe to grind can shut you down. Early career, you know, researchers are often feel constrained in terms of what they can say and do. But then, you know, there also is some kind of standard for methods that has to be upheld. And
yeah, but know, unfortunately, the, as you point out, as soon as I encountered trolls and you know, flame attacks on the internet, I thought, wow, this is just like university academia.
Right.
Some prof at another institution is going to read your work and then decide, I'm going to take this person out. I'm going to start a controversy, which will only increase my standing.
Right.
So they attack you.
Yeah. So it's that, but then there's also elements of, you know, what you might call bad actors, right? Like with respect to the Nazi revisionism, I see a lot of like anti-communism behind that, right?
Yep.
Because it's like, if we, you know, if we can equate, and we are sure going to talk about a lot of this, but if we can equate Nazis and communists to each other, then, you know, they're equally bad. And, you know,
oh no, they're not. That's the whole argument.
The communists are worse.
The Nazis were trying to save us from communism.
They're trying to save us from communism.
If only we had let Hitler drive east and destroy communism.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, yeah, that's got to be unpacked, but there's propaganda of so many kinds there. And then there's, you know, and then there's the fact that like people, you know, they read Facebook, you know, they're getting their information from, you know, filtered in these ways that the tech monopolies have some considerable ability to influence. And they tell you what you want to see already. They drive you more and more towards, you know, certain things. So it's, yeah, it's tough. It's tough to uphold, whatever, some kind of scientific standard or whatever it is that we're trying to do.
Well, there's one more problem I wanted to mention, and that's over specialization. You mentioned the, you know, the funding available, because that's what university seems to be about, right? Getting, getting funding. Teaching is well down on the list of a professor's responsibilities or interests, that's for sure. Yeah. I think everybody who's been in university can remember the profs who you could tell they didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And when I was doing my master's, I heard some things that I can't unhear. like a professor basically describing the layers of a university with the microbial bacterial undergrads to the semi-primate grad students, you know.
Oh, that's helpful.
No, not really. Not really. but there's there was, in my time anyway, a tendency to over-specialize to the narrow, narrow field where you are the world's leading expert on, you know, Mayan crop rotation. Now, I'm not knocking the importance of Mayan crop rotation, but if that's, you know, your thing to the exclusion of everything else.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is why, you know, we structured this podcast this way as like a, you know, intro course kind of idea where we're not, you know, I don't have a, you know, if I have a specialty, it's, you know, U.S. foreign policy and third world countries, right? Like that's what I've written actual books about. But here we are talking about 17th, 18th, 19th century history because, you know, we want to give people that background that we have, but not as specialists. We couldn't specialize in all the stuff we're covering.
No, no.
So yeah, from my perspective, you know, I've also used this podcast to read a bunch of stuff that I've always wanted to read. So, you know, the three big examples for me are, well, four: Hope, Philippines, Hawaii, 1857, India, the Opium Wars. I don't know. So for me, I've loved doing this just because it's forced me to read books that I, you know, had shunted way down on my reading list. And
And you've loved this because you forced me to read things that I hadn't read before.
I'm happy to have contributed to your education.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you've been doing that for a long time, but yeah, this time you definitely pushed me in directions I wasn't expecting to go. The most famous of those would be the statues episode, where Justin sent me a list of 48 individuals. Said, you know, should these people, I had to look up every single one of them. Maybe half of them I knew their names, and the other half were complete strangers. But it was an interesting experience for sure. Yeah, and I also learned when you made me read some pretty horrific things that I'm, even at my age, I'm not jaded. I can still be surprised and even horrified by things that I read.
Yeah, it's brazen, right? For me, I've always said, I wrote this in one of my books. I find it appalling the way they lie so brazenly, almost more than the atrocities. The atrocities are awful, but like, you know, the David Irvings of the world or whatever, like they're, the way they can just brazenly say things that are, you know, demonstrably false. It's like, that's what I find shocking still. And I find it shocking every time.
Yeah. the defense of the atrocity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the cover up.
Yeah.
Or the next step, which is simply ignoring it, omitting it from the narrative completely.
Or yeah, or the rationalization, or you know, like the Jamaica episode where they formed a committee to defend the guy that did these massacres.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the committee had all these prominent people on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wanted to talk, you may, I don't know how tuned in you are to the controversy in the United States over something they're calling critical race theory. Now, critical race theory is actually something that's taught, I think, in legal studies at university level, but the Republicans have gotten very upset that critical and passed resolutions that critical race theory shall not be taught in our schools, and their teachers apparently getting fired for teaching what is critical race theory. And I think whenever people say, when Republicans say critical race theory, they mean like basically that New York Times 1619 project, which you remember when we mentioned it. I said, if you search for it on the internet, you'll find critiques of it before you'll find it.
Yeah.
So I think the idea is, in a sense, a lot of what we've been doing because, you know, of this obsession that I have with racism would be considered in by Republicans as critical race theory. So, here, you know, I mean, you probably have not had, I mean, what kind of, you're retired, you're safe now. What kind of repression, was there any repression of what you were trying to teach or any control over what you could do in history class?
Not really.
But you also don't have a formal academic freedom protections or anything like that.
Oh gosh, no. No, the limits are... what are my students going to tell their parents? Because one parent's complaint is enough to kill a program. You know the stories of books being removed from the curriculum, like,
yeah,
you know, To Kill a Mockingbird being yanked because it's got a word in it. Right. No, the limits were more, as I say, in terms of resources. So they give you a textbook, and if you are teaching a class for the first time, you're relying heavily on that textbook. It's the only thing you can put in the students' hands until you know the topics better yourself and can start to bring things in, like, you know, pictures or music or activities, or until you've taught the course a few times, and then you can start doing more what you want rather than relying on what you're given. And we've mentioned textbooks before and how politically charged they are. And they're not great. They're really,
yeah,
not.
And I mean, they're rewriting the textbooks to make them even worse in the U.S. because,
yes,
they're responding to this critical race theory that they see under every rock.
Yeah, and see, critical race theory, why not just do the real history?
Yeah, but that's the thing. That's what they're, you know, they don't distinguish, Republicans don't distinguish between real history and... They're calling everything critical race theory because it sounds fancy and academic and inaccessible.
Hmm.
And you know, that's the way they nail these Marxists. They also say that Marxists have taken over the U.S. education system.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a thing. If I'd been teaching history in the States,
yeah,
the odds of with their political attitudes, with their political climate, the odds of a student going home and telling,
yeah,
mom and dad, you know, this is what we studied in class, and then, yeah, you know, me being drawn up on the Scopes Monkey Trial Part 2.
Yeah. So you wanted to ask, or are you asking me, or am I asking you what we would change if we started over?
Wow. Well, there'd be more material to add.
Yeah, even more.
So it would be longer and longer, and maybe become unwieldy.
Yeah, it's you know, that's part of why I wanted to stop here and start a second series, well, second and third series, because this could get unwieldy.
Yeah, this is this is Justin's choice to go to a second series. I would have included the Scramble for Africa in this section. I probably would have started doing it right after the scientific racism material, but I'm not questioning your decision. I think it's right. We can do a good job on that if we put it as a separate series.
It's also my motive, you know, that's the motivation I mentioned, where there's a lot of stuff, a lot I want to read about it. So might as well use it. They say that the best writing, you know, your writing is good based on how much you cut, you know, the quality of the material you cut out of your draft. But that does not apply to podcasting.
No.
Just make notes and add and add and add. But so we're near the end, but I made the following notes for episode one. So I wanted to evaluate how we performed in terms of our own objectives here. So why are we doing this series? Out of the belief that history can prepare you to understand current world events. I think we can do that better than the way it's taught in the mainstream by adding world, you know, the rest of the world, the wider world, and history from below. We're going to go through the modern Western curriculum. We're going to add our own studies and spins to make it more worldly and more of a people's history. And then we're going to question things like, is history always propaganda, and can we do history in a fair and balanced way? So how did we do?
I might be a little biased, but not too bad.
Not too bad, right? So yeah, I think as we go, here's my last full disclosure, which we'll have to do again at the beginning of the next series, but you know, my perspective is going to be pretty, shall we say, pro-commie as we go forward. I've been reading a lot of Domenico Lasordo and that kind of take. And Lasordo was, I think, a member of some Italian communist party and talks a lot about history. He's, you know, about the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, that kind of project, which he thinks of as, you know, a really important project of universal, you know, universalism, I guess, right? Like,
okay,
it's not based on racism and it's not based on imperialism. Even when they fail, those are the standards. Anyway, I'll get into my defenses of it in the moment. So you want to say anything about where your perspective will be and how
I'll just be rolling my eyes while Justin does his commie stuff. No, I definitely have a more Western view of things. Can't really escape, you know, who I am and what I grew up with, but I'm probably, we were laughing earlier. I didn't know whether to describe myself as an anarchist or not. And I just came to the conclusion that, well, no, I couldn't belong to an anarchist group because I'm a prototypical anarchist. I don't want anybody telling me what to do.
Well, there's two sides to anarchism, right? There's the mutual aid and solidarity. And then there's the, you know, radical freedom, libertarianism. So
yeah, I'm not one of those.
You're like an Oscar Wilde anarchist. You don't want to be in any group that would have you as a member.
Something like that. Something like that.
So yeah, I just think probably when we're into World War One, Two, especially Two, we may have a little bit more formal debate. Be it resolved.